Let's be in order, please. Oh, did I get Exhibit 5 back?
You haven't.
Let's not lose that. All right, this is a continuation of North Dakota Public Service Commission case number PU-08-932. Mr. Swanson.
Thank you, Judge. We would call Jennifer Turnbow.
Ms. Turnbow, as you heard me advise a previous witness, and as you well know, your testimony is required to be under oath, and I'm required by law to advise you regarding perjury before administering the oath. Perjury is a false statement of material fact which you do not believe to be true. In North Dakota, perjury is a Class C felony, punishable by a fine up to $5,000, imprisonment for a period of up to 5 years or both. Will you raise your right hand, please? Being advised regarding perjury, Ms. Turnbow, do you swear that the testimony which you're about to give in this matter shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I swear.
Mr. Swanson.
Judge, good morning, Ms. Turnbow.
Good morning.
First, can you just give a quick background on your professional experiences and maybe also an overview of Catermas, Lee, and Jackson?
Sure. Commissioners, Your Honor, I'm Jennifer Turnbow, and I work at Catermas, Lee, and Jackson. And Catermas, Lee, and Jackson is an engineering, surveying, and planning company. We have been in this state since 1938. Currently, we have 14 offices in 5 states throughout the Upper Great Plains. I have worked at KLJ for the past 8 years, and exclusively in the Upper Great Plains. My role at KLJ is I'm the work group manager for the environmental group, and I also manage large-scale environmental projects, those through large-scale permitting processes or else NEPA projects. I also focus on agency coordination, public involvement, and I specialize in energy, renewable energy, large-scale corridor, and transportation projects. Prior to joining Catermas, Lee, and Jackson, I worked for 4 years at the University of Idaho's Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Resource Unit. I have a Bachelor's of Science degree in Environmental Science from the University of Idaho, and I am a native North Dakotan.
Thank you. And Mr. Sternhagen discussed this some in his testimony, but as the project manager for the application, could you also give a description of sort of the overall approach that was taken on this project for project siting?
Yeah, as Chris mentioned, we did more of a deductive or iterative approach to the project. And this project started around 18 months ago, and one of the first things that we did is Catermas, Lee, and Jackson conducted a critical issues analysis, and we used the avoidance and exclusion criteria outlined in the North Dakota Conversion Facility Siting Act, along with a lot of other categories as well. We sort of built a GIS database from this, and we've built on that foundation ever since. Another important aspect that we did right away is we started the project off by meeting with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We also attended an interagency committee meeting in Bismarck, and those meetings are held, and like the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is there, the North Dakota Department of Health, the North Dakota Department of Transportation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, North Dakota Game and Fish, etc. And then in June of 2009, we followed that up with a scoping package that we sent out to federal, state, tribal, and local agencies and entities. And as Chris had alluded to, too, we started out with a much larger study area of about 50 square miles, and then through this iterative process of using field studies, desktop studies, and just other research, we then, the study area was lowered to about 30 square miles and eventually probably will be around 18 square miles. We had many different types of studies, field studies, desktop studies for the project, approximately about 15 or 14 studies throughout the whole project. And again, the layout was revised and modified based on this information that we found. And we had numerous coordination, which I will get into more detail later in my testimony, with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Ecological Service Office in Bismarck, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Wetland Management District in Culm, tribal representatives from Sisseton, Wahpeton, Standing Rock, and Rosebud, also with the State Historic Preservation Office, and officials from McIntosh and Dickey counties.
You mentioned that there have indeed been a number of studies, and those are all part of the record. We don't need to get into details unless questioning from others takes you there, but could you at least give an overview of the various studies that were performed under your supervision?
Yes. I'll start out with just a quick summation of each of the studies. There was an RF study done, performed by Evans and Associate, a search, and they searched for FCC licenses and FCC applications for microwave communications within a 40-mile radius of the project area. The study also looked into radio frequency facilities, interface of electromagnetic fields, as well as blade interface on radio communications. We also did a desktop and sort of a habitat assessment for threatened and endangered species. Catermas Lee and Jackson conducted that, and we looked at different habitats in the corridor for the endangered whooping crane, the threatened piping plover, and the endangered gray wolf. North Dakota birding, Dr. Bob Anderson, who is a professor at Valley City State University, conducted an avian assessment in the spring of 2009 and 2010, and this was mainly to identify raptor nests. He identified 10 raptor nests within the project area, and setbacks from these results have been incorporated into the project. Bob Anderson from North Dakota Birding again also conducted sharp-tailed grouse-like surveys in the spring of 2009 and 2010, and he identified 17 active grouse-likes, and setbacks for those also have been incorporated into the project. Dr. Bob Anderson also conducted a piping plover habitat survey, and the results of that survey were no piping plovers were identified during the survey, and then there was minimal potential piping plover habitat identified in the project area due to very high waters. Western Ecosystems Technology conducted a whooping crane habitat review study, and the goal of this study was to develop and implement a desktop review and analysis of the whooping crane habitat resources in the project area, and to compare these resources to areas outside of the project boundary north, south, east, and west. The study analysis concluded that the habitat for migrating whooping crane does exist in and around the project areas. However, the project does not contain the only suitable whooping crane stopover habitat. Dr. Erin Gillum with NDSU conducted a bat assessment, and she did that using Anabat ecolocation devices to determine if bat populations are present within the project area. There were 5 bat species that were identified during the course of the study. And the project also has incorporated avoiding hardwood shelter belts during construction to preserve habitat for bats. One of the bigger studies that was done and the field surveys was a Class 3 cultural resource inventory. And first of all, the Class 1 literature review was conducted in May 2009. And because most of the project area had not been previously inventoried, Catermas Lee and Jackson recommended a Class 3 cultural resource inventory, and the State Historic Preservation Office concurred. This inventory was conducted between 2009 and 2010. A total of 2,792.5 acres were inventoried. The inventory was also carried out with the aid of tribal monitors from Sisseton Wahpeton and from the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. A total of 166 previously undocumented cultural resources were recorded. Since all facilities are avoiding cultural resources, a finding of no significant sites affected and no historic properties affected determination was made. The State Historic Preservation Office concurred with this determination on September 4th, 2010. An FAA pre-screening study was also conducted by Inesco, and they have submitted their FAA Form 7460s, and the results of the recommendations of marking and lighting wind turbines and 60 determinations of no hazard and 62 determinations of does not exceed have been acquired. The wetland delineations were conducted by Cadamus Lee and Jackson for the project in August and November of 2009 and June and July of 2010. In addition, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife mapped and identified 66 wetland basins under easement by the employees of the Culm Wetland Management District. And on January 31st of this year, the U.S. Army Corps reviewed the wetland delineation report, and the project does not contain any jurisdictional wetlands. Therefore, a Section 404 permit will not be needed. We also did a Phase 1 environmental site assessment. Cadamus Lee and Jackson conducted this. And there were no identified hazardous waste sites, underground storage tanks, or one-time use permits within the project area. During the Phase 1 environmental site assessment reconnaissance, several locations were identified that may contain potentially hazardous material. Most of these are farm sort of related, the pesticides, herbicides, petroleum products, etc., and it's not anticipated that any hazardous waste sites will be encountered during construction.
Thanks. And I know, again, Mr. Sternhagen discussed this some, but could you give a brief discussion as well of the sort of an overview of the agency contacts and responses throughout the course of your work on this project?
Yes. For the scoping package, we received 18 responses back. We solicited 84 agencies in our package, and most of the coordination, like I mentioned, we had met with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife, the Culm Wetland Management District, the State Historic Preservation Office, Sisseton Wahpeton, and that type of thing. But probably the biggest coordination that we've had was with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Ecological Services Office in Bismarck. And sort of a timeline of that is we've met approximately 8 or 9 times, and that's not even including the numerous coordination we've had via email and telephone. But we did meet with them, as Chris alluded to, on November 16th. And out of that, actually, let me back up. We met with them in October, and that meeting was, well, actually, we met with them on September 8th of 2010. I apologize. And out of that meeting, the purpose of the meeting was to discuss potential effects to whooping cranes as a result of the proposed project. And from that meeting, what we did is we conducted a whooping crane habitat assessment that Fish and Wildlife had recommended that we do. And that was to look at all the wetland acres within a half mile of the proposed wind turbines and access roads in order to identify potential whooping crane habitat that may be affected. And we did do that study. And we anticipated about approximately 1,743 acres of wetlands. What we did with this study and this information is UNESCO will be putting those acres and possibly more acres into conservation easements. And this model you should be fairly familiar with was used with the Basin Project as well. And we've met with the North Dakota Natural Resource Trust to carry out sort of these conservation easements. Since that time, we have met with Fish and Wildlife numerous times, and we did put together the biological conditions and effects summary, which is Fish and Wildlife wanted something that they could actually really read and dive into the project, and that's when we submitted the biological effects and or conditions and effects summary.
And just to make clear for the record, that's Exhibit 4 in the record.
Yes. And through this this summary and this study that we did submit to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, what we really did is we further assessed the potential for piping plover habitat in the project area. There is critical habitat about 1.2 miles away from the closest turbine. And what we did with this desktop level assessment is we looked at soil types at the two designated piping plover critical habitat locations, and we analyzed that to identify commonalities. And then we went back through aerial photography from 2003, 2005, 2009, and 2010, and we analyzed this data to see if there was any potential piping plover habitat in the area. Due to such the high water years that we've been having, there are currently no potential piping plover habitat, but we did find about 23 acres that if all the stars aligned and the weather cooperated and it was perfect, that those 23 acres could potentially be piping plover habitat. And so what we did is, since we had these 1,700 plus acres that that UNESCO plans to put into conservation easements with the North Dakota Natural Resource Trust, we also said that there should be at least 24 acres that would be suitable for piping plover habitat in our conservation easements. And as Chris said in his testimony as well, we did have a meeting recently with Fish and Wildlife Service of January 25th of 2011. And we are continuing working with Fish and Wildlife Service to come up with more minimization measures and commitments that will be part of the project.
The application certainly presents the conclusions of the various studies at that point in time and the mitigation plans that are in place. Is there anything that you want to add to that discussion at this point?
Yes, we are currently revising this biological conditions and effects summary, and there are some commitments. If you read through there, we will be doing an avian bat protection plan and post-construction mortality monitoring, and there will probably be other commitments to avoid and minimize as we work through this process with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Anything further that you wanted to make sure that we discussed for the record before questioning from council, staff, or commissioners?
No.
Mr. Armstrong, but let me interrupt before you get started and say to the people who are present, I intend to recess for lunch. I do not intend to do that now, however. I think we'll do better if we forge ahead a bit with this witness, and we'll see how the testimony goes. And if we can finish, great. I would then recess for lunch. But I think now we might as well avoid what I assume is the everybody else who's eating lunch at the same time. So we'll see about a lunch perhaps in another half hour, 45 minutes or so. Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Turnbull, I'd like to, start off right at the end of what you were testifying about, and you mentioned you're currently revising the biological summary, which is Exhibit 4, I believe?
That's correct.
Is that something that's certainly going to be revised?
Yes.
And are you in the process of revising that right now?
That's correct.
Is there a anticipated completion date for that revision?
As soon as possible.
I'm just wondering if this is something we should have marked as a late exhibit would be the revisions to the biological summary. I'm you know, we can't have a late exhibit that might not ever exist, mm-hmm. but if it's something that will certainly exist, I think we should have it entered as a late filed exhibit in this matter. And is it something that will exist in the near future?
Yes.
I would like that revision entered as late filed exhibit number 10.
10. It would be late filed exhibit 10. And how would you have it identified, Mr. Armstrong?
I think Ms. Turnbull, what will that exhibit be called?
It'll be called the Biological Conditions and Effects Summary, and it would probably just be not the November 2010, but either
let's call it the updated biological
or revised.
Yeah. probably.
Since there are two options on the record, I'll break the tie and say we'll call it the updated.
Works for me.
All right. The late filed exhibit has been requested. Late filed exhibit 10, described as the updated biological conditions and events summary. Mr. Swanson, objection?
No objection.
The late filed exhibit is received. Late filed exhibit 10.
Mr. Trimble, you talked about the piping plover and there being, I think, 23 current acres of piping plover habitat and the remaining 1,000-some acres not being current habitat because of high water. You know, being from North Dakota, you know, water levels change and such. I mean, is that once there's high water, you know, making it uninhabitable for piping plover, does it go back to habitable, so to speak?
I guess what I meant with the 23 acres was that what we did is we looked through the entire project area, and it was a desktop study. So what we did is there's designated critical piping plover habitat that's protected by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So what we did is we took that designated piping plover critical habitat and we analyzed the soil types. And then we took those soil types that were common to the designated critical habitat, and then we looked in the project area to see if there were any commonalities with the soil types. And so that was just really potential, that may be potential on piping plover habitat, the 23 acres.
Okay. And
that would just be if there were no other factors identified into it other than those are the soil types necessary for habitat for piping plovers.
And
so it would have to be almost a perfect scenario.
Okay. And not talking about those 23 acres, you'd mentioned something in your testimony about other acres that were not habitable because of high water. Could you explain that further to me, or am I misunderstanding?
The 1,700 acres is a wetland assessment that we did for whooping cranes. And that was what Fish and Wildlife had recommended, was within a half mile of the project area, look at all the wetlands in that area and a half mile out to see how many acres of potential stopover habitat for whooping cranes. And that's what I was referencing with the 1,743 acres.
And I saw this in the application, and you said it during your testimony, and it doesn't include the only whooping crane stopover habitat. Does this area include whooping crane stopover habitat?
Well, pretty much all of North Dakota is potential whooping crane habitat. So any sort of wetland, whooping cranes are opportunistic, so they can stop. If you're in within this migration corridor, which North Dakota is, there is always a potential for them to either stop or roost or rest.
Has there been anything done? I know this was application was filed or the letter of intent anyway was filed in 2009. Has there been any observation by somebody on the ground seeing if any whooping cranes were in this area or not?
The closest documented observation of a whooping crane has been about 6 miles north of the project area.
Where is, and is that documented somewhere with U.S. Fish and Wildlife?
U.S. Fish and Wildlife. They keep documented observations. And they will be the first to tell you that, you know, that data may not be, you know, exactly kosher at times because they just take calls from people who do see them and that type of thing. So,
would the noise and shadow questions be better for EAPC, or is that?
That's correct. Yes, I will defer.
And Mr. Sternhagen referred me to you on the piping pullover, and I apologize for jumping around a little bit here, but what was done as far as observation, as far as whether there are actually piping pullovers, you know, within the project area or very close to the project area?
Yeah, a piping pullover survey was conducted by Dr. Bob Anderson, who is a professor at Valley City State University. He also owns a company called North Dakota Birding. And he did do a piping pullover survey, and no piping pullovers were identified during the survey. And he also said that there was very minimal potential piping pullover habitat identified in the project area, and that is mainly due to such the high water years that we have been having.
Okay. And I think that's where I got the high water and the piping pullover.
Okay.
is that you're understanding that, you know, if we have low water years, which we tend to go up and down here in North Dakota, that it could be, you know, more piping plovers in the area. I mean, or was there no determination made as in that regard?
I don't know about numbers, but I mean, there is potential for habitat if there were, I mean, if there was sort of, there always could be potential for habitat, but there is designated critical habitat, you know, like 1.2 miles away.
And you mentioned these conservation easements that are under discussion with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Is that, are you in the process of getting these easements, so to speak, or is that something that'll have to happen once the discussions are completed? Is the amount of easements and such part of the discussion, or are you right now actively in the process of getting these conservation easements?
No, not actively. Where we are in the process is we submitted to Fish and Wildlife sort of our understanding of the conservation easements, the land values for the conservation easements, how many easements that we would have under conservation, and they had some comments and that we should consider. And so we are in the process of revising the acreage and possibly the land values, and then resubmitting that to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And then INESCO will be working out a contract, per se, with the North Dakota Natural Resource Trust, and they would be the ones who would actually get the easements.
You had discussion about the 10 raptor nests. I think you said 17 grouse nests.
That's correct.
And the incorporated setbacks for those. Mm-hmm. How far are the setbacks?
For the grouse, it's a quarter mile from all of the active lek sites from March 15th to May 15th. And for the raptors, it's a quarter mile from the red-tailed hawks and Swainson's hawks, and a half mile from, and I'm going to slaughter the name of this, Fruinagus hawks.
And is it your understanding that that amount of setback is sufficient for, you know, from turbines to protect these birds?
Yes, and in Bob Anderson's reports, he had documented where he came up with the setbacks and the reasons why, yes.
As I understand it, the project layout with the turbines is, I mean, it completely avoids any areas of cultural concerns and environmental concerns that were found?
That's correct. The project does avoid all impacts to known cultural resources.
And that includes the roads and the underground lines?
That's correct.
Tell me a little more. I'm a little unclear from the application and from the testimony about the relationship here with the tribe involvement. Could you tell me about that? And, you know, where does that come in?
Sure. As part of our scoping package that we sent out, Assistant Wahpeton did receive one of our scoping letters. And once they received that, a representative from Assistant Wahpeton had called me and said that they would really like to have tribal monitors out with the archaeologists while they did the Class 3 cultural resource inventory. And so INESCO made the decision that they would have the tribal monitors out. And so the tribal monitors worked directly with the archaeologists from Cattermist, Lee, and Jackson on the project.
did the tribal monitors raise any concerns about, you know, the area or, you know, having the wind turbines in the area?
No, the tribes are very happy that we are avoiding all cultural resources, and we have worked hand-in-hand with them throughout this entire process. And Sisseton Wahpeton has been the main tribe that we have worked with, and they've sort of taken this project kind of under their wing, or they've been the main contact for all the other tribes. We also held a meeting in Mitchell, South Dakota, with four other tribes, and that was a request from Sisseton Wahpeton.
In this area, you know, and I'm not from here, and what's the significance of this area to the tribes? Is it geographically close, or is it just a special area to them? Can you give me some details on that?
It's in close proximity to the Whitestone battle site. It's about, I'm not exactly sure how many miles away, but that's basically the reason why they asked to be monitors, because it was close to a battle site.
I'll turn it over to commission staff.
Mr. Leon, any questions?
No questions, thank you.
Questions from the commission. Commissioner Clark.
If, and again, thanks for your testimony. If I rather defer this question, let me know. I'd asked about the closest residence to a turbine, and it was happened to be a participant. Do you know the closest residence or the closest turbine to a non-participant residence? And if
I
that
don't.
Can be provided later, that's fine.
I might have to defer either to the map or to Chris.
If you can, with an exhibit, Mr. Swanson.
Sharing with the witness one of the maps, there's part of exhibit 5.
Can I share this with Chris? I don't.
They want to recall it.
So yeah, let's. I would rather recall Mr. Sternhagen.
That's the only question I have.
Any further questions from the Commissioner Kramer?
Hi, Jen. Are you familiar with any history of piping plovers colliding with wind turbines? Do you know of any incident like that?
There has been no documented cases of piping plover and turbine blade strikes.
Can you give some sense of odds or likelihood that those 23 potential acres would ever become suitable to, I mean, piping plover are largely Great Lakes shoreline birds, is my understanding, and I understand why there's some habitat that would be suitable around here, but I sensed from your description of the potential that the potential was very unlikely, and I'm a little concerned by, you know, the request for a late filed exhibit, and I'm hopeful you'll be able to provide that. I'm a little uncomfortable with the whole U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service accommodation, and wondering at what point does the line get drawn, and the appropriate reasonable people say this isn't going to happen. And so if you could give me some sense of the odds of that potential being reached, it would be, might be helpful. If and maybe that's unfair to ask of you, but you're the only expert I'm looking at right now.
You know, I really don't know if I could give you odds of that happening. I think Fish and Wildlife's, you know, major concern is the possibility that it might happen. And since what Terry has told us repeatedly is, since the piping plovers can't speak for themselves, they have to do everything they can to protect the piping plover. And so I don't know if I don't think I could ever give odds on that, no.
Well, then let me just follow up. What's the next creature that can't speak for itself that might possibly be, you know, hang around and get hit by a wind turbine? That's just a rhetorical question.
I have no idea, but I'm sure we'll find out.
Yeah, I suppose we will. I also, sort of commenting on Catamus Lean Jackson's role in all of this, and I noticed several very nice pictures. You've documented very well, pictorially, several potential cultural sites. And one of them that I noticed was a dump. When you come across something like that, is there anything that's done to sort of, besides identifying it and documenting it, that where you notice a particular artifact or the potential for any type of artifact and how that might be shared or whether it's even important? Because it's hard to not notice a picture of a dump ground in a cultural resource.
I'm not sure how to answer the question. I'm not an archaeologist, but Jen Hardy, who was the principal investigator for the project, is here, and she could answer that question for you.
Well, if we don't go real long, I don't know that it'll be critical to this, you know, sighting for sure, but it's more of a curiosity. Because one of the things, Jen, and I think maybe you and I have talked about this before, but that always impresses me about these proceedings, and especially one that's as thorough as this one's been, that the application is the impressive inventory of new finds, whether they're cultural sites, natural resources, and the role that development actually plays in assisting preservation and conservation of our culture and history. So it's sometimes you're punished for your thoroughness, perhaps. But at any rate, that's all I have, Your Honor. Thank you.
Further questions from Commissioner Calk.
Thank you, Jennifer, for your testimony. Yeah, where are you from in North Dakota? You said North Dakota native. What town?
I'm from New Salem, North Dakota.
Very well. We all know New Salem well. It's interesting, as Commissioner Kramer was asking his question, I think that I had some illumination of how this might have played out with your testimony about Basin and the 23 acres of potentially conservation easements. And it's just kind of speaking out loud. It's Basin's wind farm had a federal nexus.
Correct.
As you're well aware of, but basically for the rest of the crowd, that just means that they've got to come to some conclusion of finding of no significant impact or do something. And so the layer of environmental review that goes in that is much more than, I won't say better, but a lot more. And if that has become the standard that the Fish and Wildlife Service is now instituting on all of our development, that's unfortunate. That's something that we'll perhaps look at later as a commission. But it appears that has now become the de facto standard that you're being held towards is what would be required for normal full-blown NEPA assessment. I mean, would you have any comments back to what I just said as far as agree or disagree or assessments of that? I mean, you've got a background in NEPA and Fish and Wildlife Service, quite honestly.
I would say that, yes, it seems that that's kind of what they're more leaning towards, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, if there is a federal nexus or not. I don't know if it'll become a standard with them, but that's what it seems as if the process that they're kind of going down.
Sure enough. And the way we do it in North Dakota, I think we meet all the mandates of NEPA without the extra bureaucracy. And they're quite honest. We've got clean air, clean water, good fish and wildlife and all that stuff. But enough about that, I guess. In your first part of your testimony, you talked about a review of FCC electromagnetic interferences or something like that. What do you mean by that exactly?
There was a search. There's a search that's done to look at point-to-point microwave services and also like radio frequency, if there's going to be any sort of impact to like radio stations, digital TV stations, radio and TV broadcast signals, that type of thing.
Because where I'm going with is we've had some meetings with up at Grand Forks with the airbase and the aviation school up there about potential wind turbines throwing off radar and things like that. So you have some data somewhere that shows that turbine rotation could throw that off, or what's the concern that you're looking at there particularly?
I believe that we were looking at just sort of the impact to the households within the project area, if it would, you know, disrupt like HDTV, that type of thing, their signals to that.
So do you have data that shows that there is disruption that we could look to somewhere, or that's just something that you know? Or
I believe the study is in the appendices to the application. And I think that what the study, the final results were that the project, you know, could potentially impact maybe 22 households.
Sure.
And that would be handled kind of on a one-by-one or case-by-case basis if there was disruption.
Fair enough. And then it's been a while since I did wetlands dirt determination. What's the latest and greatest on how do you determine the wetland with these changing water levels. I know it used to be 2 years of hydric soil or something like that. What do you, how do you approach that now with an ever-changing environment like we have?
Well, they look at different parameters to do the wetland delineations. And again, I'll have to kind of reiterate, I'm not a wetland specialist. We have a wetland specialist here today. But they look at the different parameters, and if they meet to what are those three parameters, okay. And then they identify
but
and
there was
map
nowhere
the boundaries.
That was that this project affected it. Okay, I think that was it. Thank you.
Any further questions from the commission? Follow up, Mr. Swenson?
No, Judge.
Follow up, Mr. Armstrong?
Just a couple quick ones, Your Honor. And I want to talk to you about this updated biological summary, which we've marked as late filed Exhibit 10. It's my understanding, you know, we can't have a late filed exhibit that might never exist. It's my understanding that's something that's currently being prepared and something that will be submitted to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the near future. Is that correct?
We'll be talking to Fish and Wildlife Service actually tomorrow. We have a meeting scheduled, and they did request some additional information from a January 25th meeting that we had. And the method that we wanted to do that was to update this biological conditions and effects summary. However, if U.S. Fish and Wildlife does not like that method, then we probably won't update this current report that is out there. So I would say the chances are that we probably would definitely update this biological conditions and effects summary.
Probably, definitely.
Well, you know, I guess I'm pretty sure that that's how they want us to do it, but I guess I'm not 100% positive, to be clear.
What I want for the record is I guess I wasn't requesting, you know, the results of your U.S. Mm-hmm. Fish and Wildlife Service negotiations because we don't necessarily know how that's going to play out, so it does no good for that to be a late filed exhibit. But if this is something that will be exist in the near future, you know, I guess that's what we'd want, just to have the most current up-to-date information. And that's the purpose of my late filed exhibit request. And is that something that will exist and that we can have as a late filed exhibit, is your understanding?
Well, I guess to be 100% sure, we're not sure if Fish and Wildlife at this point is going to have us revise this or update it. We will know tomorrow, so I'm not sure how you want to handle.
I think, Council, what we could commit to, because I think the record would benefit from additional documentation on this, is there will be a follow-up filing made, and we will call that follow-up filing the updated biological conditions and effects summary. It may or may not be a simple recopy and addendum to what is already in the record. But there will be a standalone document filed in follow-up.
Okay, that'll work. And then Commissioner Kramer asked you about any documented piping plover collisions with turbines. Are you aware of any documented whooping crane collisions with turbines?
No, there has been no documented collisions with whooping cranes or to blade strikes.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Lean, anything further?
Nothing further.
A follow-up by the commission. Follow-up, Mr. Swenson?
No, Judge.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Turnbull. Bring me Exhibit 4, please. Thank you. We'll be in recess for, 45 minutes. So let's be back here at about 1:15.